Bob McCown, it's John Shannon. Well, Shannon, welcome to day one of the Major League Baseball lockout. And the only question really that is of importance here is how many more days will we have of the Major League lockout?
I think we're going to be into the 90 to 100 day.
That's exactly
scenario.
What I was going to say. Exactly 90 to 100 days. I was going to say 100 days.
And you know what, Bob? I've been around baseball and the labor disputes, even going back to when I was in high school. But I have covered enough hockey lockouts. By the way, if you work for a league, it's a work stoppage. if you're a player, it's a lockout. So for the work stoppage / lockout, you end up having to put on so many hats. You end up being a lawyer. You end up being an accountant. Yeah. My goodness gracious, it's one of those things where you wonder what's going to happen, and really in the end, what is it all about? Rich guys getting richer.
Well, yeah, and I mean we all take that in context, and just for clarity, you know, if you work in the media, a lockout or a work stoppage in the off season is a great thing because there's lots more to talk about.
Yes.
A lockout or a work stoppage that cancels games is horrible.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot less to talk about. But we're going to talk about it from a variety of perspectives, not just the lockout, but what the Blue Jays managed to accomplish before the lockout. Our pal Shai Davidi will join us when we come back after these messages. Well, it's McCown, it's Shannon, and
I'm not on lockout, by the way. I'm not on a lockout.
Well, clearly you're here.
Yeah, I'm not locked out yet.
But baseball is. Shai Davidi of Sportsnet is with us. I can't think of anybody more appropriate to chat about this with. As of midnight last night, the fear has become the reality, and baseball has a lockout. If you're a fan who is, I was going to say younger than 30, but I don't even know what the age would be, who can remember or can't remember the last lockout in the mid-90s, well, tell them what they should be concerned about, fearful of, or not concerned about.
I mean, it's pretty incredible. There's been multiple generations of baseball fans that have not been through this. And, you know, for those of us who knew this as a normality between the period of 1972 to 1995, when there were 8 interruptions, you know, this is a hearkening back to a bad end or the bad old days, you know. So I think if a couple things to keep in mind. You know, I didn't like Major League Baseball's positioning of this as a defensive lockout. I thought that was it was pretty disingenuous because, you know, this really wasn't necessary by any stretch of the imagination. But at the same time, I think, you know, it's worth keeping in mind that if this was going to happen, it's better to do this now as opposed to, you know, a couple of weeks before spring training or, you know, in the middle of the season, obviously. So, you know, this is the point in time where the least amount of damage can happen to not just the regular season, but to spring training. There's certainly enough runway for both sides to avert anything ugly. But the other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, these things can spin out of control once you're in them. Right. You know, there's a lot of emotion out there. It's pretty raw. I talked to a player yesterday and, you know, he was got a pretty good feel of where, you know, his teammates are at. And, you know, it's tough. Like they're not in a good place. And then I think you could see by the tone of Tony Clark's reply yesterday and his statement that, you know, kind of where the union's mind is at collectively. So, you know, this can certainly spin out of control. But at this point, you know, I don't think people should get sucked into the, you know, the PR fight that both sides are going to be engaged in and realize that, you know, this is to some extent a technique or a tool that is common to bargaining and that both sides have started staking their ground through extended periods of negotiation and, you know, are probably right now taking a cooling off period to assess kind of where they think the other side is going and where they think they can find common ground.
You know, the interesting thing is in that, and Bob kind of touched on the fans not being used to the lockout, neither are the players. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a 30-year-old player in Major League Baseball, the story of the 94 World Series, the 95 lockout, it's a story of myth compared to anything else. So that's the other thing. But it's such a contradiction, Shai. How does anybody sit there and see all the money spent this week and think that there's a problem and issues in baseball?
You know, I'm trying not to be tinfoil hat guy and conspiracy theory guy, but as the spending bonanza was taking place at the last week, I'm like, I wonder if this is going to somehow end up in the owners' communication. And sure enough, there it is in Rob Manfred's open letter to fans yesterday, where he says, we spent $1.7 billion in salaries on players in November, and it's going to be a record by the time the season's end. You know, the union claims free agency is broken. So it's a really odd juxtaposition, right? It's not exactly the natural segue where it's like, you know, our industry is in major trouble. We need to have this. Like, yeah, that was a bonanza like we haven't seen. And if there had been more of that in the 4 years preceding this one, under the current agreement that just expired, then yeah, I don't think we would have been in this spot at all anyways. So, you know, I think that there's going to be a disconnect, and it's going to be hard for some fans and, you know, definitely players and even some of the baseball industry to say, we just went through that and now we're going through this. Like, how do you switch? Like, it's literally like going from light to dark and, you know, just, you know, turning a switch on a wall. You know, I think that's going to be really hard for a lot of people to reconcile. But, you know, that was really a mask of, you know, long-standing symptoms that had been under the surface for a long time.
So my recollection of the multitude of lockouts that we went through in that 20 or so year period that you were talking about is that there always seemed to be one major issue that everybody talked about. And then they would talk about, well, there are all these other little issues. And what they do is they one by one kind of settle all the little issues. And then they get down to like a handful of things. This year, and I read the piece that you wrote for Sportsnet. There are a bunch of issues, but I'm not sure I have been able to identify the issue. Like, what's the one that is going to be the last thing they do or the end of game stumbling block, in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question. So I think the ultimate piece is going to be the revenue sharing / competitive balance tax threshold /
but they already got two. Now you see,
they're interconnected, but they're interconnected, right? And like and the competitiveness of teams. I think those three issues are interconnected because, you know, what has essentially happened since the 2002 agreement, where the sides came to the brink in the middle of the summer, and then, you know, got a deal in, is that there have been these pieces that have been implemented into the subsequent agreements that progressively have moved the sport closer to a cap world. It's not a hard cap world. It's not the NHL, not the NBA, not the NFL. But they've got this artificial ceiling in place where the vast majority of teams are effectively treating the competitive balance tax threshold as a ceiling. And because of revenue sharing, that, you know, teams don't need to be as competitive. They can go on these periods of tanking and they can just sit things out in free agency. And, you know, there's some other elements in the system that, you know, incentivize them to take that route, because it's, you know, if you're going to finish, you know, 15th to 17th in the majors, you're better off finishing 27th to 30th, because then you can really manipulate things in the draft. And all these pieces really feed into one another, Bob. So, you know, it's not one thing that resolves this. And that's why I think this one is going to be pretty complicated and they're going to have to be a little bit creative. But, you know, if you take a little bit less revenue sharing, You know, if you raise the threshold for the competitive balance tax, if you put together a few different pieces, then, you know, implement a draft lottery, something that, you know, the Major League Baseball has already put it on the table. You know, maybe do a couple things to, you know, reward teams that just missed the playoffs with an extra draft pick or something like that. All of a sudden you're incentivizing competition, which is better for the sport. You know, it's better for owners and for players. And now you're starting to move the line where, you know, in the past it was one dramatic thing where, you know, I think this time, you know, what the players are trying to do is to incrementally roll back some of the things that player that the owners have incrementally gained over multiple CBAs.
I don't want to be perceived as a guy who's pro owners. That's always unpopular. and many times is inaccurate. But some of the things that the Players Association are bitching and complaining about are curious to me. They I know the rev share thing is an issue, but they are presenting the scenario that if more teams spent more money, there would be more money for free agents. In other words, that there'd be more teams involved in the bidding. But that does not mean that the net result to an individual player would be higher. That's purely theoretical. Mm-hmm. You know, we always believe that, you know, if you've got eight teams bidding, well, how different is it going to be if there's 10 teams bidding or 12 teams bidding? The other thing is the notion of teams preferring younger players because they're cheaper. Well, there's no doubt they are cheaper. And maybe there should be some compensation or adjustment there. But take a look at the Houston Astros, for example, who essentially tanked for years and were terrible, but built their organization up and now are among the top spending teams in baseball. So that cycle is not going to pertain to every team. Pittsburgh Pirates are never going to spend anywhere near the top. The Tampa Bay Rays are never going to spend anywhere near the top. You were going to say, John?
Well, it's interesting you bring up those two teams because Tampa is the poster child for the system working. Because they're still competitive, even though they don't draw people, even though their revenues are lower than most teams, they are still competitive. Pittsburgh is the antithesis of that because they draw well, they don't compete, and they still make a boatload of money. And so what's the incentive for the Pittsburgh Pirates to be good? If you're the owner saying, you know what, I can put ceilings in my own personal thresholds on things, and I've got a gold mine here in Pittsburgh.
Well, yeah, and my argument is if I'm an owner and I'm sitting across the table from these guys, I'm saying, look, all you're really trying to do is put more money in your pockets. We get that. But the issues that you're raising that allegedly would correct that are false. They don't have any reality to them. You're nodding your head, but I don't know if that agrees or maybe you disagree or agree.
I think there's some merit to what you're saying there. I'll play devil's advocate on this one.
Go ahead.
So if you're, let's use the Baltimore Orioles as an example.
All right. There's a good one.
There's a good one.
Because they've spent aggressively in the past and they've gone out and gotten players and handed out big contracts and they've been an absolute abomination. Right. They have literally said, we do not care about big league talent. We're just going to throw out these cheap players. We're going to lose as many games as we can. We're going to keep getting draft picks. We're going to try to build a critical mass of young players. And, you know, for 3 years now, the Baltimore Orioles have been unwatchable. You know, they are. I mean, I think everybody kind of knows it and it's just sort of like kind of rolls their eyes at it. But I mean, that's terrible for the sport. Like they're literally not trying and they're, you know, like I feel bad for the players in that situation.
They're
like,
not trying to win now. They're trying to win somewhere down the road.
Again,
no different than Houston, except Baltimore hasn't been able to get that critical mass of young talent.
Exactly. But you can be presentable through that process, right? Add a couple of three, four decent free agents, guys who've been in the big leagues, guys who can, you know, give you some performance that can offer a measure of resistance to the other clubs that you're facing. I mean, I just think about that final weekend in Toronto. when, you know, it was just a complete and utter capitulation, right? The Blue Jays completely stomped them. And obviously there were differences in motivation. Baltimore couldn't wait to get home and the Blue Jays were fighting for their playoff lives. But, you know, there's just not enough professionalism in that. Like, can't have that in your sport. I think
your players don't give a shit about that. They really, it becomes how much is in their wallet.
I would actually argue that, to Shai's point, I think the players do care about it. And I'm wondering why they care about it. There's still the 40 jobs in Baltimore. There's still a major league roster. To Shai's point about the last weekend for the Blue Jays, hey, tell that to the Red Sox and Yankees that they played earlier in the week and beat. The ebbs and flows. I just want to know where do Major League Baseball players get off trying to manage the sport as opposed to just managing what the players are involved in? I'm being the devil's advocate, but there seems to be a moving line. Tony Clark, why are you worried about that?
Because it directly affects players, right? And I think the argument is that it wasn't always like that. And I can think back to a conversation I had with a Blue Jays executive during the J.P. Ricciardi era. So, you know, we're talking in the, you know, mid-2000s at some point. And back then, you know, the owner said, you know, the executive said, you know, the one thing that, you know, the Blue Jays have never done is the Blue Jays have never really bottomed out. They've just kind of stayed in the middle. And if you look at it, it doesn't make sense to kind of be in the middle of the pack, either be really good or be really bad. That's how you can really leverage things. Now, since then, other pieces have fallen into the puzzle that only incentivize that process. Right? You think about the way the draft works. It's not only do you have access to the higher picks, you also have more money to spend the higher you pick in the draft so that you're able to better manipulate the draft. You can say to certain players, hey, you know, just keep saying no, slide down to here. We'll pay you above slot because we can, and you can get better talent. So you can, if you're good in the draft, if you're smart, you can really manipulate the system and dramatically impact things. And so that's real incentive for teams to say, you know what, I'm not going to try. And so what that's in turn done is killed the middle class of the sport.
Right.
Right. The player who's got some experience and is pretty good, but maybe not dramatically better than the player in the 0-3 control period. And, you know, if you're a team, you just say, you know what, I'll just play the kid. I'll save myself $2.5 million. And there's not a tremendous variance. And subsequently, you've had seasons where there may be, you know, 10, 12 teams, 13 teams that are trying, you know, some that are rebuilding and some that are actively trying to lose. And I think that there's trickle down impact on players, which is why there's the concern from the union side on that one. To some degree, I think it's understandable, but it's also, is this what you want your sport to be, where you have, instead of a more balanced group of clubs trying to compete and maybe distributing the talent over a wider array of clubs, or you have these concentration of talents on clubs who are in a win cycle, while clubs in a lose cycle are essentially saying, we're out and we'll wait until we get a group of young players who we think we can win with.
Okay, so I understand and I agree, but here's what I would say to that. Who's the lowest paid guy, a regular player for the Jays this year? Who was that? Was it Alejandro Kirk? Who would it be?
Yeah, I mean, any of the rookies who were at the major league minimum.
So how do you sit there and say that and say the end of the middle class when George Springer and Alejandro Kirk are sitting in the same team picture? Because I would argue that they killed the middle class. In fact, a lot of the onus is on the players that have gone out and been able to generate giant contracts. That money's, there's going to be no trickle down. And so there is an onus on the players and the agents. and a responsibility of the players and the agents to say, listen, we need as much money as we can get for the players, but it's not going to everybody. It's going to 8%, 9%, 10% of the guys who make all the big money.
That's exactly right. And it's the same in all sports.
Yes, it is.
I used to say that the worst deals done in the National Hockey League, it didn't matter who the player was. Just show me how much they paid. And if they paid him around $5 million a year, it's a bad deal. Because a $5 million deal in the National Hockey League was for a guy who was just a little bit better than average and was easily replaceable. And it ate up, you know, a chunk of your cap space.
Yeah. And end of the middle class is absolutely correct. And we've seen the end of the middle class in all four major sports in North America.
Well, right. Yeah. And I think that's why Major League Baseball, the proposals that they've presented to the players thus far, they've been largely about adjusting how the money is distributed, but not adjusting the portion of revenue that they are distributing to players, right? So they're saying, hey, these are your concerns. Well, we can do this. We can pay players like this, and we can do this, and all those types of things. And I think there have been a few schools of thought on this that, you know, if you do raise the major league minimum to a substantial sum, that you may restore some of the middle class of free agency where, you know, it's the players like, well, you know, do we like this guy more than we like the cheaper guy we have in house? You know, at that point, you know, if the gap is not as wide between the two salaries, if the, you know, the player in the 0 to 3 service time tier is earning, say, you know, $1 million, $1.5 million as opposed to $600K. You know, there's the that sort of, you know, lower middle tier free agent where that has some experience but has some flaws, has some warts, but you know, at least what you're going to get, you know, and that guy is going to be, you know, say $2 million or a little bit more than that. Maybe at that point you're like, okay, well, why don't we just pay this guy the $2 million because we know what he is, and then something goes wrong, we still have the younger guys the backup. And you know, I think that's something where ultimately, I think the sides can find some middle ground on as a way to correct that. But, you know, the system is such that, you know, young players in the game are also, you know, disproportionately played when they're providing overwhelmingly the majority of the value, right? So, you know, just, I think that if you look at it, if I'm Vladimir Guerrero Jr., right, he made roughly $605,000 last year as a 1+ service time player. Now, you know, I just picked not picking on this guy just because I was looking up salaries and he fit, but a player named Brian O'Grady was released by the Tampa Bay Rays, and he has less service time than Vladimir Guerrero Jr., but because he was able to free himself of the 0-3 service time shackles, he signed a deal as a free agent with the San Diego Padres that would have paid him $650,000. So Brian O'Grady, because he was released, because he's not a great player, was able to make more money than Vladimir Guerrero Jr. last year. Is that the type of system that you want? Does that make sense? And that creates some of these issues because, you know, some players, if you do survive to free agency, teams at this point aren't valuing them the way that they are. You know, they're much better at modeling age declines and things like that. You know, that impacts who they target. So, you know, the free agent payday for most players isn't there the way that it might have been in the past. And all of a sudden players are like, well, you're not paying me full value when I'm young. I can't make up for it once I get to free agency when I'm old. So how is this system working for me? And so, you know, that's a bigger picture thing that, you know, the sport needs to reckon with. And I do believe that owners, at least some of them, are convinced that they need to find ways to get more money into the hands of young players because the system is so weighted against them.
Oh, it is. And I will give you that. And I'm not sure I know what the answer is. I mean, one of the things that's been suggested is, okay, we'll make players ARB eligible earlier. You're not going to make them arbitration eligible after 1 year, are you? But it's something better. Or increase the minimum significantly. But then, of course, everything is give and take in a negotiation. And so the owners come back and say, all right, let's not allow anybody to be a free agent until they're 29 years old. Well, that's turning the clock back.
Mm-hmm.
Not just in baseball, but in every sport. Mm-hmm. You now have players who now can be free agent eligible at 25, 26 years old, mm-hmm. theoretically. So, I mean, therein lies the dilemma. With every give, there's a take, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you got to decide, you know, depending on what side you're on, whether that take is better than the give.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the interesting one on that is how it would affect players because they're getting into the major leagues at younger and younger ages.
That's
so take Vladimir Guerrero Jr. You know, if you were to implement that change, you know, as things stand now, he'll be eligible for free agency after the 2025 season. If you moved free agency to 29 and a half, it would be after the 2028 season. You know, that those 3 years, extra 3 years of value. I mean, that's literally tens of millions of dollars potentially. So,
yeah, but if you have, if that player is eligible for arbitration during that entire period, yeah. is he going to get tangibly less than what the market would pay him, in your opinion?
Well, yes, because, you know, arbitration. So, you know, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. as a super two player, you know, there's every year there's a handful of players who become eligible for arbitration after two seasons as opposed to three. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is among those who qualified for that. So he's going to enter the arbitration system and he's going to make, you know, roughly $8-9 million, depending on how the process plays out. That's a massive jump. But if you put Vladimir Guerrero Jr. in free agency right now, you know, is he getting, you know, $200 million on a multi-year deal? Probably.
Well,
maybe more.
Yeah, maybe more. But, you know, well, but again, that's theoretical because the owners are never going to concede to
that. Of course. Of course. But just kind of just to say the gap, like just to underline, you know, one of the issues, like, you
know, I get
young players are the greatest value in the game, right?
Agreed.
You get such a massive discount.
Agreed.
On them. And, you know, I mean, teams are certainly built around that, right? Like the San Diego Padres, you know, they gave out mega contracts to Manny Machado and Fernando Tatis Jr. Because they felt they had enough young players to get payroll efficiency on other ends of their roster,
right,
that they could sustain that. And so, you know, at that point, you know, the owners will say, well, hey guys, they're just distributing the money based on how the system works and we can change the distribution. But, you know, unless there's some sort of link to revenue, you know, you're not growing your share of the pie.
Well, yeah, and the link to revenue has all kinds of complications. And because what revenue are you including and how accurate are the numbers? And
it's
and nobody trusts the other side.
Cap. Yeah.
And, you know, and then you have the ceiling where, you know, the tax kicks in. And, you know, and again, I could argue, okay, if you give Vladdy $200 million or $300 million or $500 million, and he might be worth any of those numbers, we don't know, it's going to get sucked out somewhere else.
Let me ask you, and I don't know the answer, and I'm asking it from for sheer curiosity. You know, the Boston Red Sox own 80% of Nesson. You talk about Baltimore, they own 100% of Masson. The Dodgers are big into their own cable sports network. Where's the
Blue Jays own Rogers or vice versa?
Yeah, that one's a little different, but I understand. But so where does revenue from ancillary television and broadcast and things like that fit into a collective bargaining agreement in Major League Baseball? And basketball, it's basketball BRA, basketball related revenue BRR, hockey related revenue in the NHL. Where does it fit in baseball?
So in the revenue sharing, they have a sort of a local pool that the teams generate that they all contribute into and then subsequently distribute. And so that would include, you know, contracts from regional sports networks and things of that nature. But you know, I think one point the owners will argue is that a lot of the regional sports networks are in trouble amid the cord-cutting transition, and that this period in recent years in which, you know, the regional TV contracts have been massive, massive boons for teams and allowed them to spend in ways that they hadn't previously. You know, like before the Cincinnati Reds, for instance, gave Joey Votto his massive contract, you know, they were on the verge or had already signed a huge TV deal there. Then, you know, those two moves were made in tandem, essentially, you know, and we've seen similar teams from other, you know, smaller to mid-market clubs timed with that as well. But, you know, with them being in trouble, you know, I think the owners will point to that as a significant headwind for the sport. You know, I think players will point to gambling money and, you know, owners' investments in, you know, essentially sports anchored real estate developments that we've seen in Atlanta and St. Louis and KC and other places, you know, as a significant revenue generator. And the sides will argue over, you know, what counts, what doesn't count, what the players deserve access to, and what they don't. So, you know, I think that's, it's certainly because the other sports are in cap systems, you know, that piece had to be very well defined, where in baseball, you know, there isn't that definition. There's that definition for revenue sharing amongst owners, but not in terms of how players are compensated.
We've got to take a break, but one of the things I've always wanted to, I'd love to sit in these negotiations and put something on the table, because players whine and complain about rev share all the time on the part of the owner. Rev share basically pertains to ownership. Has anybody ever sat across from a players association and said, well, why don't you institute rev share? Why don't you take all the money that's signed by, you know, all the $30 million contracts and take 20% of that and give it to the players that you think deserve it? You know, why don't you get involved in revenue sharing? And if you get involved in revenue sharing to some extent, we'll get involved in revenue sharing more to our extent. But that conversation, I assume, has never come up. And of course, the Players Association would say, pshaw to it anyway, because all they're interested in is more money. They're not interested in equal distribution of money. They're just interested in more, period, end of story. You want a quick comment on that?
Yeah, I think you're ready to lead the sports world's Bolshevik revolution with that kind of talk.
Well, you know, I mean, at some point, you got to fight fire with fire.
I get what you're saying, but you know, obviously, you know, if you're a player or you're an employee in any industry and you're inside a collective bargaining process, you're going to try to secure as much revenue for your constituency as you can, and that is the responsibility.
But the union concept and collective bargaining in sports is so completely different than the history of it and the way it exists everywhere else. Essentially, you know, you're trying to raise the minimum and everybody makes something relatively the same, dependent upon their job definition, dependent upon their stature, years served, that kind of stuff. There's not a grotesque difference between one guy working at the steel plant and somebody else working at the steel plant doing the same job. Sports is completely different.
Of course. But they're trying to establish as free a market as possible within the confines of a sporting system. That's what each of the unions is trying to do.
They're trying to get more money is what they're trying to do.
And the owners are trying to get more money too.
They're trying to keep it. Yeah. Right. A spade is a spade.
Well, the interesting thing is that when Shai said, you know, when you're an employee, I don't think there's any athlete in any professional sport anymore that thinks he's an employee.
I agree.
I think he views himself as a partner. I think he views himself as a business partner now. And I think that's one of the things that's changed.
Well, they think they're more important than anybody else in the system. And they might be right. Look, I want to talk a bit about, we only have a few more minutes. I want to talk a bit about what the Blue Jays did before the lockout hit. And good, bad, or indifferent. Shai Davidi is with us. We'll come back with more after this. It's McCowan, it's Shannon, it's Davidi.
Hey, Bob, before we talk about the Jays, can I just ask one more question about this?
No, but go ahead.
Okay, thanks. That's good. You know, that's good. This is a union that's run by a player, Tony Clark. How does that differ than the other unions and in previous negotiations when it was run by a lawyer? And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
So I know that there are people on the player side you know, agents, et cetera, who believe that they, you know, they were led obviously by Don Fear beforehand, and then he was replaced by the late Michael Weiner, who is widely renowned as one of the smartest labor lawyers around. And, you know, Tony Clark replaced Michael. And, you know, at that point, that's where, you know, some people on the player side will say, you know, the union lost its way a little bit because they lost that professional leadership and they lost the expertise. And, you know, Tony Clark's strength is in rallying players and building relationships with players. But, you know, he's a former all-star first baseman. He's not trained as a labor lawyer and didn't go to law school for that. So, you know, I think that's why you saw the players hire Bruce Meier as their lead negotiator. He's the one who's doing the butting of heads with Deputy Commissioner Dan Halem right now. And, you know, that's a dynamic that's different. And I think that's something that was born out of the past two negotiations.
Mm. All right, let's get to the Blue Jays in our remaining couple of minutes here. One of the interesting things that has happened, well, a lot of interesting things have happened, but Blue Jays had three significant free agents, two pitchers and a second baseman. They re-signed none of them. We had a conversation about the possibility of them signing two of the three, very little about the possibility of signing all three, but there seemed to be a sense that they'll get at least one of them done. They wound up getting none of them done, but in the process, they signed Kevin Gausman instead of Robbie Ray. And I use that term loosely because I don't mean it to say that it was an absolute either or. But what is intriguing to me, Davidi, is their contracts are essentially identical. There was a time, and I thought we were still in it, when left-handed pitching was valued much higher than right-handed pitching was because of the scarcity of it. So same money, similar stats from last year. One guy's a left-hander who you know. The other guy's a right-hander who you know less but have aspired to get. Was it as simple as that for the Toronto Blue Jays? It was going to be one or the other. Gausman finally said yes, and they jumped at it.
I think there's a little bit of that to it. It's also a little bit more nuanced. And, you know, I think that people kind of look at the total packages, you know, the 115 versus for Ray and versus the 110 for Gausman, it'll be like 5 million, really. But it's a wider gap than that because Ray has an opt-out after three seasons, whereas Gausman does not. It's just a straight 5-year deal. And that opt-out carries tremendous value and is of significant volatility to the club. Second, the Blue Jays get a compensatory draft pick for Ray signing elsewhere, and there's significant value to that. And then the third piece is that from Ray's end, you know, the difference in taxes between Washington State and Ontario is also $7 million. So once you put it together, you know, the gap is much wider than simply $5 million. So I think that's piece one to keep in mind. Two, you know, I tried to ask Ross Atkins about this and, you know, he didn't bite quite obviously, but, you know, my sense is that Gausman was ready to make a decision beforehand and that, you know, some of the gap that I just outlined might've been a bit of an issue on Ray's end. And so, you know, Robbie Ray has ultimate choice in this process. And, you know, I caught his news conference in Seattle yesterday, and he talked about kind of fit and how, you know, the process with the Mariners moved very quickly. And, you know, I got a sense that, you know, the impressions that I got when I put the pieces together, it seems that Gausman got to yes first, you know,
he did. Jays, yeah, I agree.
Yeah. The Blue Jay, but, you know, tied to that is that to get a yes from Ray, the Blue Jays probably would have had to spend a little bit more or a lot more potentially. And, you know, in their eyes, it really was sort of, we got to get one of these two guys. And, you know, in a lot of ways, Gausman is right-handed Robbie Ray. And, you know, I think you can look at their, you know, their track records and make a case that you can feel a little bit more comfortable
with Gausman.
With Gausman than with Ray.
I agree.
Because of the way that they profiled and, you know, just how scary, as much as, you know, Robbie Ray made a tremendous jump and most people think he's going to be able to maintain it moving forward. I mean, 2019, 2020 guy is in there too.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean when the Jays are allowed to go shopping again, they're shopping for a left-handed starter?
No, I don't think specifically to that they'll be shopping for a left-hander, but I think they're, you know, I think the best predictor of what they're going to do is what they've done to this point. And, you know, they've shopped for a starter at the upper end of the market, and they've shopped for starters in that sort of middle to lower tier, you know, sort of the $8 to $12 million range. And so I'd expect them to try and get another starter in that category. And we're going to see them go after an infield type. And then we're going to see them go after a couple more relievers. I think that's the, you know, that's what they've done. That's what they've shown us so far on the market. And I'd expect for that to continue.
I can't wait till the time that some team decides that it'd be better to only play seven guys in the field because they need two extra relief pitchers. to sit in the bullpen. No,
you know, here's the thing. Just make the relief pitchers outfielders. Do the Ohtani system for the bullpen and the right fielder. You know.
Yeah. Instead of sitting on your ass waiting for to throw shag the three flies. Batters, go shag some flies.
I can't remember who it was, but there was a team a couple of years ago that, you know, put a reliever. They made a change. They put the reliever that was on the mound on the field, had the reliever coming in pitch to a batter, then brought the reliever that had been in the field back onto the mound. So, you know, that I feel like it was the Cubs under Joe Maddon, but I could be wrong about that.
Sounds like a Maddon move.
It's been out there.
Just quickly, with Semien gone, I've asked Bob this question. He doesn't think so, I don't think. But does that give Biggio a chance to be the second baseman?
I do think that Biggio's got a chance to play a bigger role next season. And, you know,
that sounds like Ross. That's very Ross-like of you.
I mean, you know what, though? Like, the way that he's talking it up, like, I mean, either he's just kind of throwing that into the market for, you know, people to digest, or it's legitimate. And I don't think that he would artificially raise an internal player's hopes. You know, that's just a bad situation. So it sounds like Biggio is going to get a chance to be more active. They, in an ideal world, I think he's back at second base rather than at third base, but you know, I think they're going to go wherever the best player they can get. You know, right. I think that, you know, the infielder maybe comes to them via trade and, you know, they get somebody to plug in with some, you know, efficiency to the contract that allows them to do some other things. That would be my guess as to what happens. But, you know, I still think a lot of options are on the table for them.
Would you trade Hernandez for a third baseman?
Premium third Hernandez? Baseman?
Sorry?
Teoscar Hernandez?
Yeah, that's the one.
No, I don't. I don't think I mean, again, depends who.
You're going to have to pay him. Get ready. You're going to have to pay him and Biggio
but you can just run things out with him for the next 2 years and then, you know, have him walk, right? Because you need that production too. And he's such a great player that it's okay to have players walk as free agents, right? I think that, you know, the Blue Jays could trade from their outfield, but, you know, you're losing Marcus Semien already. It's going to be hard to replace him. You know, Teoscar Hernandez was such an important offensive piece in so many ways. You know, not only was he was kind of cleaning up and protecting for the hitters in front of him, but he was also setting the table for the guys behind him. I think
that's a really tough
skill set to replace. So I don't know that you would necessarily do that. I think what you're trying to do is trade future for present value. And so, you know, I think that the Blue Jays would look to, you know, I'm I'm certain that they've been calling Cleveland on the regular about Jose Ramirez. I would guess, you know, Ketel Marte from Arizona, you know, this is a name that, you know, I think I'm just speculating on, but, you know, Jorge Polanco from the Twins really makes a lot of sense for them. You know, I think that those types of players are out there from teams that could potentially be motivated to make the deal. And they'd probably be looking more for future pieces as opposed to present ones.
Well, I can't argue that. I'm just saying to you that there's going to come a moment where the Blue Jays are going to realize you can't pay everybody.
Oh, for sure.
And that day is coming. And Hernandez seems to me to be a piece that would have market value and maybe better to do it early rather than late.
Mm-hmm. I understand that. It's an interesting one. It's for sure an interesting one. I also think that, you know, maybe you just let that one run its course and, you know, assuming it's still in the next CBA, take the compensatory draft pick if he signs elsewhere.
Well, which would you rather have, a compensatory draft pick or an actual trade that you get some tangible return for?
But I mean, you're also getting 2 years of performance, right? So it's 2 years of performance plus, you know, the tangible pick. And, you know, the other thing is that it's harder to get kind of present value back for that, right? Because, you know, a team that's going to be, unless you find a team that really has it's sort of a need for need challenge deal, you mm-hmm. know,
that I get. Yeah.
You're going to have to be trading him for future pieces. And so maybe you're trading him for prospects that you're then using to make a deal for somebody else. You know, at that point, the business just becomes a little bit tougher to pull off.
Fascinating stuff. We will. Yeah. You want to take a bet as to how long this lockout lasts?
I think I'd set the over under for you know March, either like last week of February, March 1.
So you don't think spring training essentially
pitchers and catchers aren't showing up on time?
I think that there's the potential that they do, but if spring training got shortened 2 weeks, I don't know that. I don't know that everybody would be super mad about that.
No pitcher throws enough pitches in one game to warrant being there for all that time anymore. So they're all relievers.
All for tea times, Bob. It's all for tea times.
Shai, we love you. You know that. Thanks a lot, pal, for joining us. Fascinating stuff. We'll bug you again down the road.
Yeah, hopefully we're not talking about this stuff and we're just talking about baseball next time around. But
ain't that the truth?
Yeah, interesting times for sure. Appreciate it, fellas.
Thanks, Shai. Shai Davidi of Sportsnet. We'll come back and wrap it after these messages. And we're back. And our thanks to Shai Davidi for joining us. He never agrees with me entirely, though he did give me some partial agreements today, which was encouraging.
Yeah, your approach. Has your approach to these labor disputes changed? Have you morphed from being pro player to semi pro owner?
No, it depends. It depends on the situation, and I'm not pro owner here.
Well, you sounded pretty pro owner.
No, well, I just think the players are really missing the boat. I think in a union, you want to look after everybody, and they don't really want to.
Well, no player. By the way, in any sports league that I've been around and seen, the people that take the short end of the stick are the people that are going to be joining the union in a year or two. Right?
I rest my case.
Yes.
Look, we have lots of time to talk about all that, and we will. It is important, I think, to make note, not to be too Toronto-centric, but a game that people thought was of some significance for the Toronto Maple Leafs last night against Colorado Avalanche, who I think are a mirage, but the hockey pucks all love Colorado and have loved them for years, just like they loved San Jose, and they're going to win a cup, they're going to win a cup, they're going to win a cup. Well, you know, show me. Anyway, that being said, that was a pretty dominant performance.
That was a whooping, Bob. That was
an ass kicking.
Yeah. Now, in defense of the Avalanche, they did not have National Hockey League goaltending. I mean, if I'm Joe Sakic, that is my, with all the predictions that I'm going to be the best team in the West and perhaps a Stanley Cup contender.
You better get one.
That is a huge concern now for Colorado. Darcy Kemper is hurt. was Darcy Kemper going to be the guy in the end to make a difference? That's a question that they paid a heavy price for him to get him from Arizona. And now he's out. And obviously they have an issue in goal. And that's not going to be solved by Nathan MacKinnon or Gabriel Landeskog or Mikko Rantanen scoring goals.
You look at the other end of the ice and Wall's performance. You know, he was almost no different. Like raw, no experience.
Yeah.
And he's had a couple of like stellar performances.
But you heard John Tavares with us last week talk about how important when a guy like Wall is in the net, team defense is. And you've talked about it yourself, how impressive you have been with the Maple Leafs and their team defense.
100%.
So and then you have Jack Campbell.
And I was unimpressed with Colorado last night.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong. If I'm Joe Sakic, I might be on the phone the next couple of days trying to figure out whether I can actually acquire a goaltender that's going to put us over the top.
Look, we got to go. But at the end of this, an 8-3 victory and outscoring their opponents like 35-9 over this little stretch of games, whatever it is. Maple Leaf fans are happy, but cautiously happy because nothing will change anything fundamentally until the playoffs come.
And, you know, the other team that has to be really happy today are the Edmonton Oilers because they played a very impressive game last night against Pittsburgh Penguins. McDavid was dominant. Zach Hyman had a hell of a game.
Yeah,
they had good goaltending.
But they got to win a playoff series or 2-2.
They're in exactly the same boat.
Except they haven't been at it as long as the Maple Leafs had been.
You tell that to Oilers fans.
We got to get out of here. We thank you all for watching or listening, as the case may be. And we'll see you again tomorrow. Bye, everybody.